He shifted backward to put some space between them. "Tom, please." David took a step closer and grasped Tom's shoulder firmly. "Take it easy, Tom," he said soothingly. "Nothing happened." Tom's fist came up, knocking David's hand from his shoulder and pushing him away in the same movement. His head turned to glare at David, but his body stayed firmly in position.
"Get your hands off me," he snarled,
then turned back to Max, fists still clenched, his body trembling.
"And you keep your hands off my mother. You think you can just waltz into her life with your Mercedes and your expensive suits and get her liking your family, then hurt her like this?"
Max watched, stunned, as Tom shuddered in a deep breath and his eyes filled with tears. Tom took a step back and drew another deep breath.
"I tried to warn her about you. Big-time ball player with a nasty temper. But did she listen? No. She had stars in her eyes and couldn't see past your fake niceness,"
he finished haltingly, tears now running down his face.
"You don't deserve her. Just go."
He wiped his sleeve across his eyes and opened the front door.
"Go now, please."
Max stood there, trying to think of a word in his own defense. There were none. Tom was angry and hurt. And right. He knew Caroline was vulnerable. He knew she'd lived with a man who was emotionally remote, and still he let his temper have full rein over a pair of basketball tickets. Tom was right. He didn't deserve Caroline. David tugged at the back of his winter coat, and Max turned, still numb. David patted his back awkwardly.
"Come on, Max. Let me take you home."
Asheville, Tuesday, March 12th, 8 a.m. Ross folded her hands on her desk and stared at Stephen. Straddling a chair with his chin resting on the chair back, Stephen stared back at Ross.
"You're reaching, Thatcher."
Stephen shrugged. He'd been up half the night going through evidence, files, his own notes. And he agreed. He was definitely reaching. "You got anything better? I'll get right on it."
"I thought you were going to look for the legal aid attorney who started the restraining order."
"I am. I think I found someone who remembers him, but the woman's out of town until tomorrow. My brain took a different turn." Ross sighed.
"Let me get this straight. You focused in on the statue found in Ms. Winter's car."
She raised a brow.
"Finally. Working on the actual crime, I might add."
Stephen rolled his eyes and didn't care if she saw him do it. "Look, that statue had significance to Winters. He recognized it, according to the boys down Sevier County way. If it had belonged to him, he would have reported it missing after his wife disappeared. The cops went through everything in his house with a fine-tooth comb. There were inventories taken. Winters insisted nothing of his had been stolen." Ross inclined her head.
"Okay, I'll walk with you, Thatcher. So it did belong to Mrs. Winters. What next?"
"Well, I was thinking if it had belonged to her, why didn't he just say so when he saw it in the Sevier County garage?"
"Maybe he didn't want her to have it,"
Ross conjectured. "That's the direction I took. Look, we know he abused her. Don't tell me he's never been charged, Tony," Stephen spat out when she tried to do just that. "You've been over backwards trying to be fair, but the evidence is there. That woman was abused by someone, repeated and brutally. She lived with him from the time she was 15 until she disappeared at 23. Some of those wounds in those pictures are fresh. Who else would have access to flay her back apart? A cat-o'-nine-tails fairy? Come on, Tony." Ross sighed.
"Okay. Winters is a spouse abuser."
She held up one finger.
"Accused. He has the right to due process."
Stephen stood up and kicked the chair. "He has the right to—" He cut himself off mid-sentence, sucked the temper back in. "I'm sorry. I'm not normally a disrespectful man." Ross smiled, so subtly he almost missed it.
You believe passionately in your work, Stephen. I can respect that.
Her smile dimmed.
My first homicide was a domestic squabble gone wrong. I'll never forget it as long as I live. The bruised body of the wife, the children huddled in the corner, crying. I want to see the man who put those bruises on Mary Grace Winters brought to justice as much as you do. So sit and tell me how you're going to get justice for this woman and her child.
Stephen drew breath and sat, straddling the chair once again, conscious of the barrier of formality now broken between them. Would Winters have given his wife a religious icon, Tony? She shook her head.
No. He hates Catholics.
Her lip curled.
And blacks and Jews and women and homosexuals. I sincerely doubt a Catholic statue would have been a gift from Rob to his wife.
Then where would she have gotten it? Winter said she was moody, depressed, and temperamental. But believing he's a spouse abuser, it follows that he kept her isolated. She had no friends. Her parents were dead. No siblings. The only time she would have had private access to other people was when she was
in the hospital.
Ross finished.
She made a friend in the hospital.
Stephen nodded. That's where I ended up. Ross leaned forward in her chair and propped her elbows on her desk, her chin on her fists.
We need to find out who made friends with Mary Grace Winters 9 years ago.
Already on it. Stephen paused at the door to her office. You have my cell phone number?
Somewhere in one of these piles.
Ross gestured aimlessly.
You'd better give it to me again.
He did, and watched her write it on the palm of her hand. What a difference from his own anal-retentive boss. Call me if Winter shows up.
I will.
Hickory, North Carolina. Tuesday, March 12th, 7 p.m. Excuse me, ma'am. A nurse in a smock covered with teddy bears looked up. She had kind eyes, Stephen thought, but tired. It had obviously been a busy day in the ER. Her name tag said C. Burns.
Yes, can I help you?
I hope so, ma'am. Stephen showed her his shield. I'm Special Agent Stephen Thatcher of the State Bureau of Investigation. I'm conducting an investigation, and I'm hoping you can help. He really hoped she could help. Out of the 6 nurses that worked orthopedics 9 years ago, 1 was dead and 2 others couldn't remember anything helpful. 2 were on vacation with their kids on spring break. Claire Gaffney Burns was last on his list. Nurse Burns looked around.
It's relatively quiet now. We can start, but we may not finish all in one stretch.
Stephen smiled, and she smiled back. I understand completely. Can you take a break and get off your feet, or do we need to stay here? She looked around again.
The other nurses are all with patients, so as much as a sit-down sounds like heaven, I'll have to stay here.
That's fine. Nurse Burns, you worked at Asheville General 9 years ago, didn't you?
She looked taken aback.
Why, yes, I did. Why do you ask?
Stephen tilted his head.
Why were you surprised I asked?
She shrugged with one shoulder.
Because I've been here for almost 4 years and nobody asked. Now you're the second person in less than a week to ask.
Stephen narrowed his eyes. Really? When was this? Nurse Burns considered for only a moment.
Thursday evening. The paramedics had just brought little Lindsay Daltrey in for surgery.
She pursed one side of her mouth.
I can't remember the other man's name, but he was looking for someone who'd worked with me back at Asheville General in the summer of...
She opened her eyes wide.
Oh, God, that same summer. That's too much of a coincidence, isn't it?
Perhaps. Let's not get too worked up until we compare notes. What did this man look like?
He slipped his notepad and pen from his jacket pocket, poised to note anything Nurse Burns remembered. Nurse Burns pursed her lips again.
He was tall and big. Not fat, just big. Built like a linebacker.
Tall as me?
She moved her head from side to side, thinking.
Maybe an inch taller, no more. He had shoulders this wide.
She gestured, and Stephen felt his heart skip to a faster rhythm. Winters was that big. Stephen looked up from his notepad. Black hair, brown eyes? He asked. She shook her head.
No, he had gray hair and a mustache. A bushy one. His eyes might have been brown. I'm sorry I didn't pay attention to that.
It's okay, Stephen said soothingly. What did he want to know exactly?
He said his sister had met a nurse while she was sitting with their sick grandmother at Asheville, and that his sister had died recently, and he'd found a letter to this nurse among his sister's things. He just wanted to deliver it. I didn't think that there was anything wrong with that at the time. The nurse he was looking for was young, and maybe not a nurse. Maybe a volunteer. I told him the only volunteer we'd had that summer was a young woman named Susan Crenshaw. She was just about to start college in the fall. She'd wanted to be a nurse since she was a child.
Was this the person he was looking for? Nurse Burns shook her head.
No, he was looking for someone named Christy who'd worked oncology.
You seem to readily remember Susan Crenshaw. Was she a friend of yours? Burns smiled fondly.
Susan made friends with everybody she met. All the patients loved her to death. I remember there was one young woman that summer who was recovering from a broken back. She and Susan were about the same age. They talked all the time.
Stephen raised a brow. Do you remember the patient's name?
Oh, yes. That would have been Mary Grace.
She pursed her lips again, concentrating.
Her last name was a season. Oh, yes, Winters. Mary Grace Winters. Mary Grace didn't talk to many people. She was an odd little thing.
How so?
Well, she had these eyes. Great big blue eyes that looked like they could see right into you. She was always so sad. Haunted is probably a better word, actually. She had this little boy who was the joy of her life.
A corner of her mouth tipped up.
He was blonde like her. Same blue eyes. He was quiet.
Did she have a husband?
Yes. Yes, she did. He came to visit every day, brought flowers and goodies. He was, a policeman. Big, hulking.
The blood drained from her face. Nurse Burns? Stephen reached out to touch her face. Her cheeks were as cold as ice.
Oh, God.
Her eyes slid shut.
It was him, wasn't it? Her husband. The man last week.
And if it was?
Oh, God.
She whispered.
He beat that poor woman. Nancy Desmond was sure of it.
Nurse Burns, I need you to concentrate. Stephen took her hands in his, barely able to keep his own hands from shaking. Do you remember if Mary Grace had a statue of any kind while she was here in the hospital? Burns nodded, little jerks of her head.
A statue of some saint. I can't remember which one. Not expensive, but Mary Grace kept it by her bed the entire time she was here. I remember thinking it odd, because she was listed in the file as being a Baptist, not a Catholic. So I asked her about it. She told me it was the first time anybody had ever given her a gift. She said it in such a small voice. She sounded more like a little girl than a 20-year-old.
You're doing great, Stephen soothed, even as his brain screamed triumphantly. One more question. Who gave Mary Grace a statue? Burns opened her eyes. He thought them kind when he first met her 10 minutes before. Now they were terrified.
Susan,
she whispered.
Susan Crenshaw.
Stephen tugged her hands, leading her from behind the nurse's station to a chair. Sit here. I'll get you some water. He found the water cooler and came back to find her in the same exact position in which he'd left her. He crouched down in front of her and pressed the paper cup into her hand. Drink this. Nurse Burns, can I use your telephone? She jerked another nod.
Yes, of course. It's...
She trailed off. It's okay, ma'am. I'll find one. Stephen stood and looked around for a doctor. He peeked in a room and saw a young woman checking a chart. Doctor? She turned.
Yes? What can I do for you?
I think one of your nurses needs some help. Quickly, the doctor returned the chart to its slot and followed Stephen, listening intently. When they'd reached Nurse Burns, the doctor was firmly in charge of the situation. An hour later, Stephen searched the doctor out yet again. "How's Nurse Burns?"
"She'll be fine eventually. She's had a shock, of course."
He scanned the woman's badge. "Dr. Simpson, I'll let you decide how to tell Nurse Burns." Dr. Simpson's eyes narrowed.
"What?"
Stephen blinked. It had been a very long day. He drew a deep breath and exhaled it on a bitter sigh. "The woman she knew? Susan Crenshaw?" Simpson nodded. "Miss Crenshaw was found drowned in a river just outside of Greenville. Her neck was broken. I need to offer Nurse Burns police protection, should she request it." Dr. Simpson nodded.
"I've called her husband. He should be here sometime in the next half hour. You should wait until he gets here to tell them both."
Chicago, Tuesday, March 13th, 11 p.m. Winters had never seen so much traffic. Why anyone would want to live in such a gray, dirty place was completely beyond him. He finally found an empty spot along the curb and slid his rental car next to the parking meter. He was here. And so, somewhere in this dirty city, was his son. Too bad secret women's shelters weren't listed in the phone book. He'd have to find Hanover House through more creative means, which was the sole purpose of his sitting here on the corner recommended by the owner of his sleazy motel. The girls were plentiful and cheap, the old guy had claimed. Winters watched the women strut by. The old guy was right. Chicago's streetwalkers were certainly more flamboyant than those who plied their trade in Asheville, and more abundant, both in sheer numbers and in various attributes. There was enough silicone on this street to pump up every flat-chested woman in Asheville. Winters smiled at his own wit and felt the reassuring tug of his false mustache on his upper lip. No slippage. Good enough. He waited, watching for about 2 hours, when he saw the woman he wanted. She was medium height, with natural tits and an Iowa corn-fed wholesome face under her 14 layers of makeup. She had shoulder-length dyed blonde hair, by which she was currently being pulled down the street by a tough-looking black man wearing purple pants and 6 earrings in one ear. He was the wrong color to be an outraged father, so Winters assumed he was the girl's pimp. Purple pants swung Miss Iowa around by her hair until she faced him and got directly in her face, yelling something that made her eyes glaze over with fear. He hauled off and backhanded her so hard, her head wrenched to one side. Miss Iowa's cry of pain could be heard through the bustle of the crowd and Winter's raised car window. But no one stopped the pimp. Nobody cared. Outstanding. Then Purple Pants dropped her hair and pushed her to the pavement and delivered a hard kick to her ribs. She curled into a protective ball, and he kicked her again. The man had style. Winters climbed from his car and intercepted Purple Pants. "What you want?" the man asked, huffing from the exertion of bringing one of his girls to heel. "Her." Winters pointed to the sobbing Miss Iowa. "All night. What's your price?" Chapter 13. Asheville, Wednesday, March 14th, 3 a.m. Ross herself served the search warrant to a white-faced Sue Ann Broughton, who stood out of the way, wringing her hands helplessly. They dusted for prints, searched drawers, closets, cabinets, mattresses. They came up with 3 unregistered handguns with accompanying ammunition, 4 theater catalogs featuring wigs and facial-altering props, a belt with a buckle sharpened to razor edge, and a pair of boots on the back porch, encrusted with what appeared to be vomit. "What's this, Miss Broughton?" Stephen asked, pointing to the boots with a pencil. Sue Ann hesitated, wringing her hands.
"We know they belong to Rob.
Tony said gently.
I've seen him wear them myself. Many times. Why are they covered in vomit?
Sue Ann Broughton trembled.
Rob asked me to clean them. When was this?
Tony asked.
Monday morning?
Stephen grimaced and threw the pencil in an evidence bag. No way in hell he was ever writing with that thing again. So why didn't you clean him? Stephen asked diffidently.
I couldn't. Why not, Sue Ann?
Tony pressured softly.
I tried. Really, I did. But I got sick. I couldn't come close enough to clean him without being sick.
Stephen watched Tony's gaze pointedly move to Sue Ann's middle, where the woman's hand lay visibly trembling.
How many months along are you, Miss Broughton?
Sue Ann seemed to crumble before their eyes.
Two months.
Tears ran down her cheeks, and she covered her face with her hands. Does Detective Winters know? He asked as gently as he could.
No.
She sniffled and scraped at her face with the heels of her hands.
I tried to tell him, but he didn't want another baby.
Gingerly, Sue Ann touched her jaw, and Stephen clearly remembered the fading bruises he and Tony had seen the night they'd come looking for Rob. Stephen had an unholy wish to give that animal a minor taste of his own cruelty. For even a minor taste of Winters' brand of cruelty had proved fatal. Tony gently pushed Sue Ann into a chair and crouched down beside her.
Why not? Why wouldn't he want your baby?
Sue Ann shrugged, a pitiful sight.
He only wanted his son, Robbie.
Tony put a comforting hand on Sue Ann's knee, lifting it immediately when the woman winced.
Sue Ann, can I see your back?
Sue Ann grabbed the lapels of her cheap robe and pulled them tight, creating a cocoon around herself, rocking herself. Her eyes clenched and her whole body shrunk as if to take up the smallest space possible.
No. Please?
Tony said softly.
We can help you, Sue Ann. You don't have to live like this.
Sue Ann Broughton looked up at that. And Stephen knew he would never forget the look of sheer hopelessness in that woman's eyes. Because as terrified as she was to stay, Sue Ann Broughton was more terrified to leave.
Just go away,
she whispered hoarsely.
Just go away and leave us be.
Stephen knelt on one knee. He had to try once more. Miss Broughton, do you know where Rob Winters is? She hesitated, a fraction of a beat.
No.
Tony? The call came from Detective Lambert in the bedroom closet. There's something here you should see. Tony pointed to one of the uniformed officers.
Watch her. Don't let her touch anything.
Stephen was right behind Tony and nearly bumped into her when she came up short just inside the closet door. Stephen's eyes widened as he took the room in.
Nice work, Jonathan,
Tony murmured. Detective Lambert merely nodded.
Take a look inside. I've never seen anything like it.
Neither had Stephen. The room was about 5 by 10, the long wall completely covered by a mirror that ran from the ceiling down to the edge of a vanity counter that also ran the length of the long wall. Smack dab in the middle of the vanity was a sink.
I've never had a closet with running water before,
Tony remarked blandly. Or so many heads, Stephen added. It was true. Lining the vanity were styrofoam heads. Stephen counted 10 of them. 5 sported wigs, the other 5 were bald, as it were. Some of the heads had mustaches, some had full beards, goatees, sideburns. At the base of each head was a plastic bag. Stephen pulled a pen from his pocket and nudged one of the bags. It was squishy.
Cotton and saline bags, used to alter the shape of his face, Lambert supplied.
He shrugged. I'm into community theater. He has the looks for it, Stephen thought. Lambert resembled Robert Redford in his salad days, only even more golden if that was possible. Tony had stepped up to one of the styrofoam heads, bending to see a photograph precisely tacked to the wall behind it.
And even a finished portrait for the how-to,
Tony murmured.
Oh, my God.
Stephen stepped closer, studying each of the color portraits. Each face was Rob Winters's, although he would never have guessed had he not been looking. He stopped by the first bald styrofoam head. The man in the portrait had gray hair and a mustache. This is the one he used when he visited Nurse Burns. Tony sighed.
Move that APB right on up to a warrant for his arrest, damn it.
Asheville, Wednesday, March 14th, 8 a.m. The buzz in the Asheville PD briefing room immediately quieted when Ross walked in beside a guy in a black suit. IA, Internal Affairs. Why do they always dress like undertakers? Stephen wondered as he stood in the back of the room, silently watching. The black suit stepped up to the podium, and Stephen could practically feel the unspoken hisses and boos aimed at IA. As of midnight this morning, we placed an APB for the apprehension of Detective Rob Winters. As of 4 a.m., we issued a warrant for his arrest. Predictably, angry murmurs filled the room. Well, that's special, Stephen thought. No hi, how you doing? A funny thing happened on the way to the precinct? Nope, just launch right into it. He bet this guy was great at parties. Tony stepped up to the podium.
Enough,
she snapped. Every voice went silent.
We have evidence to charge Rob Winters with,
she pointed a finger in the air,
spousal assault.
She added a second finger.
And conspiracy to commit murder in the first degree.
She closed her hand into a fist and carefully lowered it to the podium.
When we find him, we will arrest him, and he will be provided the same due process to which every citizen of this country is entitled.
Again the angry murmurs. Again the equally angry snap from Tony Ross.
Enough!
Again the silence.
You think we do this lightly? You're wrong. He is a police officer. He has taken an oath to serve and protect the people of this city. He has taken an oath to uphold the law himself.
She paused and looked around.
As have we all. This is an official proceeding. We will begin an organized search at 0900 hours today. He is, of course, armed. We found an assortment of disguises in his house. He has the capability to dramatically alter his features.
She picked up a file folder.
We'll post copies of these pictures showing what he might look like disguised. Don't look for his face. Look for his build, his mannerisms.
She paused and looked out over the crowd.
You are all good people, good cops. None of us ever wants to believe one of our own can go so bad, but it does happen. The evidence against Rob Winters is very strong, but he will be treated fairly when we catch him.
She looked around the room once again.
And we will catch him. We will read him his rights and bring him in just as if he were any other criminal. He will be cuffed. Are there any questions?
Not one hand went up. She nodded curtly.
You are dismissed. Report for duty.
Stephen dragged a chair up front and placed it beside her. Tony waited until every officer had cleared the room before sinking into it. Nice job, Tony, Stephen murmured, but not one you'd choose to do again.
Not in my lifetime.
Ross looked around and sighed.
Did the Luds come in?
Not yet. Stephen had requested Winters' cell phone records the night before. Given the mobility allowed by wireless phones, records and traces always took longer to get. I asked for him to be faxed to your office. Call me when they do, okay? I have an appointment with one of the legal aid attorney's old clients this morning. I'm hoping she remembers something that will help me find him. Charleston, South Carolina, Wednesday, March 14th, 6 p.m. Have a seat, Mr. Thatcher. John Smith ushered Stephen to an empty chair across from his desk. His walls were sparsely decorated with dime store watercolors, a poster portraying a series of Charleston's historical landmarks, finger paintings done by children, presumably his, and, importantly, the North Carolina State University Law School diploma. How can I help you this evening? Mr. Smith, I'm Special Agent Thatcher of the North Carolina State Bureau of Investigation. He held out his shield for Smith's inspection. A dull red flush began spreading across the man's face. I hope you can help me in one of my ongoing investigations. I see, Smith said slowly, bringing out an embroidered hanky to dab at the beads of sweat forming on his brow. Stephen hoped for Smith's client's sake that the attorney showed considerably more finesse in court. Please, by all means, go on. Stephen watched Smith mop his brow, hoping his disgust wasn't too apparent. 9 years ago, you filed a restraining order for a woman named Mary Grace Winters. Do you remember her? Smith fumbled with the hanky, barely stuffing it in his pocket before pulling it out again to dab his forehead some more. Why, I can hardly be expected to remember all my clients from that long ago, Agent Thatcher. Stephen leaned back in his chair. Could you check your files? I don't have my files from Buncombe County in this office. They're in my home office. Stephen stretched his legs out, crossing them at his ankles. Well, perhaps I can refresh your memory, Mr. Smith. Mary Grace Winters came to you about 9 years ago to file a restraining order against her husband, an officer with the Asheville PD. You served it to the judge, who wanted a little more information before granting a restraining order on local law enforcement. That night, Mary Grace fell down a flight of stairs and ended up being hospitalized with partial paralysis. A few weeks later, you moved away from Asheville. Smith swallowed and swabbed his neck with the now damp hanky. I vaguely remember her. Why did you move from Asheville, Mr. Smith? Stephen asked, not kindly. My wife's family lives here in Charleston. We decided to move here. His eyes narrowed. How did you find me here, Agent Thatcher? I looked up your old cases in the court record. One of your clients, Mrs. Clyde Andrews, sued her neighbor for damage done to her prize roses by the neighbor's cocker spaniel. She remembered seeing your North Carolina State diploma on the wall. He lifted one corner of his mouth. She's a Duke fan, so she remembered your diploma with considerable disdain. At any rate, once I knew your alma mater, tracking you down through the alumni files wasn't that difficult. Very creative, Agent Thatcher. Smith visibly swallowed. However, I'm quite afraid you've wasted your time. I really don't remember anything that would be of value to you. Stephen shook his head and straightened his tie. I think you, Mr. Smith, are missing a critical element required for success in your chosen field. And that would be? Smith raised his brows, trying for cool and collected, and failing miserably. The lion gene. You, sir, lie very badly. We could do this via subpoena, but that would be an unfortunate use of both my time and yours. You'll either tell the truth on the stand, or perjure yourself as badly as you're lying to me now. Or you could tell me the truth now. I could invoke attorney-client privilege. You could if your client was still alive, Stephen snapped. If he hadn't been so pissed and disgusted, Stephen might have felt pity for the shock on Smith's face. But he was pissed, and he was disgusted. Hadn't heard about that? He asked in as non-emotional a voice as he could muster. Mary Grace Winters and her 7-year-old son disappeared 7 years ago. There was some question of foul play, but there was never any evidence to support it. No body in her car was never found. Until a few weeks ago when her car was dragged out of Douglas Lake.
And her body?
Smith stammered. Still none found, Stephen answered. but I believe her husband had a hand in her disappearance. I want an ironclad case of spousal abuse, and I think you can help. When Smith said nothing, Stephen added softly, "How did Winters scare you out of Asheville, Mr. Smith?" Still the man said nothing, simply sat looking tortured and sweaty. "You have children?" Stephen picked up a family picture from Smith's desk, watching his face all the while. "I'd walk through hell and back for my boys." He caught Smith's eye. "Don't make me subpoena you, Mr. Smith, because I will." Stephen turned the photograph over in his hands. Smith expelled his pent-up breath in a loud whoosh. "Damn you. Damn you for finding me, and damn you for making me feel like pawn scum." He grabbed the photo from Stephen's hand. "See my wife? She was 6 months pregnant with our daughter when Mrs. Winters came to me for the first time. It took me a month to convince Mrs. Winters the law was her best hope before she'd file that damn restraining order." He shook his head, his expression bitter. "I congratulated her on her bravery. The day after she filed, I got a call from her husband. She was terrified of him. Me? I was green, fresh out of law school and bent on saving the whole damn world. He told me to tear up the restraining order, that his wife was of dubious mental faculties and unable to speak for herself. I told him it was now up to the judge, and he just laughed." Smith dropped his eyes to the photo of his wife and son. "He laughed and said his wife had taken an unexpected fall the night before. She wouldn't be coming back to finish the work we started. Then he said, 'Your lovely wife is pregnant, isn't she? Pregnant women can be so awkward and prone to unexpected falls.' He said, 'Unexpected falls,' just like that. Scared the ever-living shit out of me. He knew where my wife worked, and that her obstetrician was on the second floor of the medical center. He knew where she went to jazzercise, for God's sake." Smith lifted haggard eyes to Stephen. "I tossed and turned for a week. Then my wife came home one day with a twisted ankle. Said she got jostled from behind on a crowded escalator and tumbled. Luckily someone at the bottom helped break a fall. And no, she didn't see who did it. It could have been coincidence, but I wasn't willing to take the chance. I never told her about Mrs. Winters or her husband. I just drew in my shingle and came here. End of story, case closed."
"Except that Mrs. Winters turned up missing," Stephen remarked blandly.
"I didn't know about that, I swear it."
Stephen leaned forward, pinning Smith with his eyes. "If you had, would you have come forward?" Smith looked down at his hands.
"I don't know."
Stephen blinked, content to roll his eyes in spirit only.
"Did you keep her files, Mr. Smith?" "Yes, I documented everything at the time."
He rose and walked to an upright filing cabinet, more government surplus.
"I kept copies in my safe deposit box just in case anything ever happened to my wife and kids."
He pulled out a file folder and thrust it at Stephen.
"Take it. They're my originals. Send me copies if you want. I'd rather never see them again."
Asheville, Thursday, March 15th, 9 a.m. Stephen met Tony Ross in her office for the morning briefing.
"Luds came in last night,"
Tony declared wearily.
"Did you find anything in him?"
he asked. Tony slouched down in her chair, her expression more drawn than the day before. She was aging before his eyes. Stephen decided she wouldn't want to know that.
"Yeah,"
she answered, her voice husky from lack of sleep.
"Not so much who Winters called, but who called him."
Stephen pulled up a chair, straddling it.
"I give," Stephen said warily. "Who called our pal?"
"Ben Jolly."
"No big shock," Stephen shrugged.
"According to Lambert, Jolly and Winters have been buddies a long time."
"Yeah, but the calls to Winters' cell phone didn't start until after he was considered missing."
Stephen grabbed the LUDs and scanned them again, matching them with the key dates and times he held in his head.
"Jolly called Winters about an hour after I got back from Sevier County. He glanced up at Tony, and she nodded. And again an hour after you told me you were revoking his paid leave. Jolly's been keeping Winters pretty damn well informed. He looked down again. But Winters was in Chicago when he received the call. He looked up again, puzzled. He's in Chicago? Tony nodded.
Far as I can tell. Why he's there, I have no idea.
You've notified the Chicago PD?
This morning at about 2 a.m.
Why didn't you call me? Stephen demanded.
Because I knew you'd be dead tired from your trip. I thought I'd let you sleep.
Stephen frowned. Where's Jolly now? Tony rubbed her hands over her eyes.
In interrogation one. Stephen, there's more. You aren't going to like it. Look at his calls for last Saturday.
He did, and the cold fist of fear clamped his heart. Every drop of blood in his body seemed to turn to ice. Oh, God, he breathed, then looked up to find Tony's gaze focused on him.
He was in Raleigh. He was near my kids.
Abruptly he stood and shoved his fingers through his hair. His heart was racing. I've got to call my Aunt Helen.
I did already,
Ross assured him quietly.
And I called Lenny Farrell. He put 24-hour surveillance on your house and on all of your kids, to, from, and during school. He said you were relieved of the assignment if you wanted to get home.
Stephen dropped back in his chair and pressed his fingertips against his eye sockets.
24-hour?
Yes.
I'll call my aunt and ask her what she wants me to do. For now, I'll get working on how Winters got all the way up to Chicago. Can you ask Lambert to help me check the airlines, just in case our boy likes to travel in style?
What did your aunt say?
Stephen looked up from his laptop, where he'd been checking his email in the relative quiet of the sweltering little conference room. Tony stood in the doorway, her expression concerned. She said what I thought she'd say, he answered. That she and the boys were fine, and I could do more good here trying to find the bastard than hovering over them at home for God knew how long. Tony smiled.
She called him a bastard?
Stephen raised a brow. Actually, I called him a bastard. Aunt Helen called him something slightly less repeatable. Listen, I'm glad you're here. I wanted to show you something. Did you know there was a website devoted to patron saints? Tony shook her head.
No, but it doesn't surprise me.
He double-clicked the mouse, eyes locked on the screen, then tilted it in Tony's direction.
Saint Rita of Cascia,
she read.
Patron saint of impossible causes. Just like you thought.
Rita bio. Tony read, then looked up with a frown.
So it all fits together. Susan Crenshaw gives Mary Grace a statue of the patron saint of impossible causes that also was an abused wife. Rita's husband beats her, dies. Rita takes her vows and enters a convent. Susan knew.
Tony? Thatcher? Stephen turned to find Detective Lambert standing in the doorway, holding a manila folder, the light from the window turning his head into a shining halo. Stephen still had to fight to keep from thinking of Jonathan Lambert as a pretty boy. But he'd do it. Tony Ross considered Lambert her right-hand man, and Stephen had come to respect her as a class act.
"What do you have, Jonathan?"
she asked.
"Please tell me it's good news. I need a little of that today."
Lambert entered the little conference room, his linebacker's body making it that much smaller. "I've examined Rob's hard drive and internet cache." He waved the folder with a satisfied smile. "Interesting stuff." And? Stephen asked. Have a seat, Lambert. Make yourself right at home in my little sauna. Lambert pulled out a chair with a sympathetic grin, sat in it, then handed him a summary of Winters' computer journeys. Up until Monday the 5th, he visited basically the same sites. A lot of porn sites, a lot of white power sites.
Surprise, surprise,
Tony murmured. Then on the 5th, he started visiting PeopleFinder databases. Stephen frowned. What? Why would he do that? He was putting in names like Mary, Grace, Mary Grace, Mary Ann, Mary Beth. Last names varied from Smith, Jones, Summers, Fall, Spring, to name a few. Stephen looked at Tony, brows nearly fused together. He's looking for his wife.
Why would he look for her? Why would he search for a woman who's been dead for 7 years?
Cognition lit Tony's eyes.
Unless maybe he thinks she's not dead.
Stephen rubbed his temple. I can't believe this.
Why would he suddenly believe she's not dead?
Tony mused. This whole thing started after he'd seen the car in Sevier County. Stephen stood up and paced the length of the tiny room. It has something to do with that statue. Tony was quiet for a long moment.
Nurse Burns told you that Mary Grace said it was the first gift she'd ever received, right? It would be important to her.
Stephen stopped pacing and stared out the window. It's a symbol.
Freedom. Independence.
Stephen thought of the hopelessness in Sue Ann Broughton's eyes. Hope.
Pretty powerful emotions.
Stephen nodded, thinking, creating a scene in his mind. Yeah. And for Mary Grace, those emotions were more powerful than fear. That car was launched into the lake, not pushed. Picture this. Mary Grace makes some friends in the hospital. Susan Crenshaw's one of them. Susan gives her a statue, and Mary Grace treasures it. She gets home from the hospital, and what will Hubby Dearest do? Break it, Lambert answered. Stephen met his eyes with a brief nod. To break her. It was cracked and glued together. She glued it back together. Maybe hit it so he wouldn't break it again. Vandalia said Winters was, agitated. Tony sucked in her cheeks.
She's outsmarted him.
Rob wouldn't like that, Lambert commented dryly. Tony's grin was wry.
No, he wouldn't, would he?
He's infuriated, Stephen continued, barely aware of their comments. But she endures somehow, makes some friends, connections, somebody helps her escape. He turned to stare out the window, not really seeing anything but the scene unfolding in his imagination. They take the car to the lake. Can you see it? She has that statue, her own symbol of freedom. She uses it to launch her car in the lake, leaving behind everything that was Mary Grace Winters. She's reborn. He stopped, wheeling around to catch Tony's eye. She's someone else now.
That would explain why she left her purse behind,
Tony agreed. And why Winters is checking databases for variations on her name, Lambert added. Tony frowned.
But why did she leave her walker behind?
I don't know, Stephen answered. But I bet we'll find out when we find Mary Grace Winters. There is one more piece of information that was irregular, Lambert said, a gleam in his eye. Well, don't keep us in suspense, Stephen returned impatiently. Lambert just grinned. He was using the yellow pages on the internet. He hooked up to the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. The computer science department? Tony scrunched her brows.
Why?
I guess, Lambert asked. He wanted a hacker. Someone who could get into the personnel database at Asheville General. The hospital's website was the last one he visited before looking up UNCC. He tried the career opportunities area, but of course that told him nothing. He may have been looking for names of hospital personnel. Stephen ran his tongue over his teeth. Susan Crenshaw. Lambert stood up. That's just a guess.
A damn good one,
Tony stated.
I feel like we're finally getting close to this bastard.
Stephen sat down in a chair heavily. If he's in Chicago, it's because Mary Grace is there, or someone who knows where she is. Lambert sighed. It's hard to believe Rob would go to such lengths to find her. He shook his head. My God, he murdered that nurse. Power, Stephen muttered. He gets his rocks off by controlling people. She outsmarted him. He can't live with that. And once he finds her, he finds the boy. Sue Ann said he was obsessed with the boy to the point of wanting no other children. We need to find him. Tony straightened her shoulders.
Before he finds her first.
Chicago, Thursday, March 16th, 3 p.m. Max sat alone in the deafening quiet of his office, staring at the note. All week she'd prepared his coffee, sorted his mail, and typed his letters. She'd greeted him with a good morning, exited with a good night, in every way the model secretary. Except that never once did she smile. Certainly never laughed. She'd stayed away from his office, coming in only once the day after that terrible meeting to pick up his papers and restore his desk to rights. He'd catch her looking at him with eyes so sad it nearly tore his heart out. Then the blue would flash with challenge, and she'd turn away. He knew what she was waiting for. But the bitterness had become a close, if not hated, bedfellow. 12 years of anguish was a hard thing to simply erase. He'd tried. God, he'd tried. He'd returned to his house after taking her home the night after their explosive fight and stood in his driveway, staring at the pole that had once held the backboard where they'd played ball as kids. He'd stood and listened to the echoes of pounding balls, grunts and hoots of glee, swishes of the net as the ball cut neatly through. All in his memory. All long gone. He'd stood and stared until David pulled him inside. Just last night, he dragged himself up the attic stairs, found the box of newspaper clippings his grandmother had so religiously saved. He'd managed his way through 3 or 4 articles before the grief returned, stabbing deep. He ran a hand down his face, trying to relieve the tension pressure behind his eyes with no success. It had been days since he'd drawn an easy breath, since he'd slept through the night, since he'd had the energy to care about anything. And although the March sun shone brightly at his back, the world seemed gray. David wasn't speaking to him, and Ma nagged him continuously to apologize to Caroline. But worst of all were the words that kept running through his mind, mostly Caroline's. She needed a man she could lean on. He wanted so desperately to be that man. For her. For himself. But it still hurt. The pain of losing his wings was still so strong it crushed him inside. And now this. He felt like tearing it up, but he only stared at her hastily written note.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to hurt you more than you'd already hurt yourself. You'll have my resignation on your desk tomorrow morning.
No signature. Certainly no love, Caroline. With a sigh of capitulation, he picked up the telephone. Chicago, Thursday, March 15th, 4 p.m. Winters was lying on the hotel's lumpy mattress smoking a cigarette when his cell phone rang. He immediately swung himself to a sitting position and answered it.
Yeah? Rob, Ben here.
Winters ground the cigarette in the cheap metal ashtray with an oath.
What are you doing calling me here? Don't you know they can trace this call? I'm using a payphone. I thought you needed to know the latest. You told me Ross revoked my paid leave and ordered me back. I told you I can't come back yet.
He was close. So damn close. One more day, and he should have the list.
Yeah, well, now she's put out an APB for you.
Fury erupted, and the hotel phone went flying into the old television set.
An APB? Like I'm some common crackhead?
His hands itched to find their way around Ross's black throat, to hear her gurgle an apology that would be way too little, way too late.
When this is over, I swear to God.
The hotel room door opened, and Angie slipped in. Rob didn't believe the hooker's name was Angie. But it didn't really matter in the whole scheme of life.
Did you get it?
He growled. Angie nodded and tossed several sheets of paper on the bed.
Bingo.
Winters held his cell phone to his ear once again.
Thanks for the update, Ben, but I got the information I was looking for. Before long, I'll be home. I'll deal with Ross then.
He disconnected and picked up the first page. It was covered with names. The guest list of Hanover House, the summer Mary Grace stole his son. He scanned the list for Mary Grace's name and came up nil.
Miss Manny?
Angie shrugged.
That Hanover House helps a lot of women.
Rob grabbed Angie's shirt and yanked her face down level with his, finding the fear in her eyes a real turn-on. He was already hard.
That Hanover House is responsible for the breakup of good marriages. The husband is the head of the household and has every right to discipline his wife and children. It's biblical.
He closed his fingers on the back of her neck and pulled her down to the mattress. Angie liked it rough.
"Till death do you part," he quoted. "And soon I'll find a bitch that made that promise to me. Then I'll release Mary Grace from our marriage," he finished to himself. "Till death do us part, Mary Grace. If that's what you want, then that's what you'll get."
Winters smiled and rolled on top of Angie, pinching her nipple through her shirt, hard. She whimpered softly. He liked to hear her whimper like that. Soon he'd be hearing Mary Grace whimper like that once again. He could hardly wait.
"Tell me the setup of the place again."
"It's an old house. It has a parking area off the street, room for about 3 cars, that's all."
He yanked at the buttons on the shirt he hadn't seen before.
"Where'd you get this shirt?"
"Dana gave it to me."
Dana Dupinsky. Angie had come back talking about her the first day she'd found Hanover House.
"The head-interfering bitch."
He stripped the shirt from her body and, kneeling astride her, ripped it to shreds with his bare hands.
"Don't be taking charity from that woman, Angie. You work for me."
She shrank away from him.
"I need to be getting back, Rob, or they'll know I'm gone."
"Honey, your job there is finished."
"But..."
He silenced her with the back of his hand.
"Don't argue with me, girl. I hired you to find a place and get taken in. You did good, pretending to be an abused woman."
He said the words mockingly.
"Asking that social worker how to find Hanover House? Making up the friend that had heard of it? Nice touch. You got into the office, broke into that bitch Dupinsky's files. That was good. You found the names of all the women who'd come through Hanover House 7 years ago. Good job again. Now you'll finish a job here with me."
"But..."
He slapped her again, and blood swelled from her lip.
"Surely you're not that stupid, Angie. Surely."
He trapped her hands above her head and grabbed the roll of duct tape he'd purchased at the corner hardware store especially for this occasion. Angie saw the tape and her eyes widened. She screamed and fought, clawed her nails down the side of his face. Swearing viciously, Winters forced her back down to the mattress, overpowering her with no effort at all. He taped her wrists together, then silenced her with a 6-inch strip across her mouth. Her ankles were last. He looked down at her face, eyes wide and terrified. She shook her head, desperate. Tears leaked from the corners of her eyes down into her ears. He smiled, stood, and grabbed one of her ankles and taped it to one of the posts at the foot of the bed, then repeated it with the other ankle. She was spread-eagled, wide open. He shrugged, looking down at her with revulsion.
"You're a hooker, Angie. Did you honestly think this would never happen to you?"
He taped her bound wrist to the rails of the headboard. He'd planned this from the moment he walked into this sleazy flea bag of a hotel. Lumpy mattress, but a great bed frame. Leaving her to struggle to no end whatsoever, he picked up his cell phone and dialed Randy Livermore. Wonder Hacker.
"I got some names I want you to run through the Illinois Department of Motor Vehicles computer," Winters said. "I'll fax you the list in 20 minutes. I want you to find their addresses and pictures. Oh, and narrow the search to any women 5'5 and under."
She could change her name and maybe even her hair and eye color, but Mary Grace couldn't change her height. Most people wouldn't even think of lying about it.
"Call me on my cell phone when you're through."
He disconnected and turned back to Angie, who was lying very still, but still breathing. That was important.
Only sickos did women after they were dead. Asheville, Thursday, March 15th, 5:45 p.m. The phone rang in Ross's office, and all present jumped in their chairs. They'd been gathered, silently waiting since 4 o'clock. Ross picked up.
Ross here.
She nodded to the group.
I'm going to put you on the speakerphone.
She pushed the speaker button.
You still there, Lieutenant Spinelli?
Yes, I am. Who do you have in the room?
Detectives Lambert and Jolly from my department, and Special Agent Stephen Thatcher, North Carolina State Bureau of Investigation. Tell me, did our idea work?
Well, yes and no. Spinelli sighed. Technically, it worked like a charm. Jolly chats with Winters, we trace the call through the local wireless company faster because they know the exact time to search for the signal, and we deploy our men to the scene.
But you still didn't find Winters. Stephen didn't even have to ask.
Spinelli sighed again. Nah, we got to the hotel too late. The room was empty with the exception of one thing.
And that was?
Tony asked, frustration etched deep in her face. Stephen watched Ben Jolly stiffen. After Tony had confronted him with his calls to Winters' cell phone, Jolly had agreed to place the call only to clear his friend's name once and for all. From the tone of Spinelli's voice, Ben Jolly was about to be gravely disappointed.
A dead hooker. Hands, feet, and mouth duct tape. She'd been sexually assaulted.
Jolly paled. Sweat beaded across his forehead.
No, he whispered hoarsely.
Tony dropped her forehead into her hand.
Sweet Jesus.
Jonathan Lambert leaned his head back, closing his eyes. Stephen watched Lambert's throat work as he struggled for composure and realized how difficult this must be for all of them. Discovering a man they'd stood with for years was capable of cold-blooded murder. Stephen cursed softly.
Broken neck?
Yep, Spinelli answered, his voice hard.
I gather this is not a new M.O.
Stephen turned to look at the photo of the broken, bloated body of Susan Crenshaw, his stomach rolling over.
No, it's not new. Did you find any physical evidence linking Winters to the murdered woman?
That's the good news. She scratched them good. We found skin under her nails. The lab will get us something tomorrow afternoon at the latest. He must have been so excited about whatever it was that she brought him that he didn't think to clean under her nails. We posted his picture and the picture you sent of his wife in every precinct in the downtown area. He'll make a mistake soon, then we'll find him.
Stephen sighed when Tony disconnected. Potato chips.
He can't seem to stop at just one.
Tony agreed woodenly.
Let's pray we find Mary Grace soon.
She looked over at Ben Jolly, whose pale face had become noticeably green. Stephen almost felt sorry for the man.
Are you okay, Ben?
Jolly nodded shakily.
Yeah,
He stood, visibly trembling.
I need to get some air.
He turned for the door, then turned back, his expression tortured.
I didn't know, Tony. I swear it.
He swallowed hard.
My God, he whispered. What have I done?
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook. Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.